Well, we got to Jacob. That's where we're at right now. We're working our way through Genesis, and we're up to Jacob's life. We look at yesterday when Jacob was born. Coming out as twins, interesting beginning for Jacob. Jacob the schemer, we call him, because Jacob grew up in a life where he does a lot of scheming to get his way. We looked yesterday at how, actually I should probably start out this morning, at least offering to any of you, if you are interested in any of the PowerPoints, they are on this little thumb drive right there. If you are interested in, I don't know if any of you guys bring laptops, I always bring a computer to a Bible camp and stuff, because it's fun to check everything out and just, you know, make notes, and I always like to check out all the information on the spot. So if you have a computer and you want to copy them, that's fine. If you don't, I actually recorded the classes, and I've got the PowerPoints. So I'll put them up on LavoniaTapes.com for any of you that use that website. Nathan's older brother, Andrew, a few years back, he sort of laughed at me listening to tapes, because I listened to tapes for a long time. And by then, CDs had come in, and he wondered why I was still listening to tapes, little tape recorders, and fooling with all that tape and the tapes getting jammed up and all that. And he finally told me one day, he said, "Dad, you waited so long to switch, you just forget the CDs, you might as well just do MP3s. And he said, "I'll create a website for you so you can just put them all up there on a website, and that way everybody can use them all around the world." So he did, and Andrew made LavoniaTapes.com. So if you've never gone to that before, there are thousands of Krista Duffing classes on there with their notes, and people all around the world upload to it. So he made it very user-friendly so that people anywhere that go to weekend gatherings, Bible schools, whatever, you can go home, upload to LavoniaTapes.com, and that way everybody gets to hear all the classes instead of just the people that were there. It's really nice, and it's also set up for notes and PowerPoints as well. And it's all free, so you can just help yourself to whatever you like. And you can either right-click and you can listen to them on the spot, or you can right-click and save them to a file and then put them on your MP3 player or whatever you have, iPhones and all that stuff today, and listen to them all. So that's really nice, and it's a nice feature to have. Now, we looked yesterday at this issue when Jacob was born, of how the tendency amongst dads and moms is to show favoritism in a family. And there's good and bad things about favoritism. You find that a bit with Isaac and with when he was born with his brother Ishmael. I don't know whether you remember, but when God talked about Ishmael and told Abraham that he would have another son, the son of the promise, you know, that Abraham pleaded with God, "Oh, that Ishmael might live in your sight." He actually was pleading for his son Ishmael, hoping that God would provide a way for Ishmael to be a part of the promise. But that wasn't in God's plan. And you find the same thing when Jacob is born. Jacob comes out as a twin. He's got a twin brother, and he's got Esau as well. And you find that in this case, Isaac loved Esau because he ate of his game, and Rebekah loved Jacob. And yet Rebekah knew, you know, to her credit, she knew that she had been told that that God had said at least about the two boys when they were in her womb, and they were struggling in her womb. She wondered, like, why? The angel told Rebekah and said, "The younger will serve the older." So she knew there was something special about the younger boy. Probably would have shared that with Isaac. And who knows, maybe Isaac was just trying to favor he was trying to favor Esau, hoping that God would provide something for Esau as well. But at least the Bible tells us that he liked his game, and that's what he did. So it's a warning in families to be careful about favoritism. But I think for all of you, the warning for us is that if you happen to be the non-favored child, you don't have to worry about that. You can still get on with life and still move on. And there's a lot of people that have been good Bible believers and good children of God, even though they weren't necessarily the one that was favored by their parent, because it does create rivalries within the family. And it seems as though Jacob grew up with this concept of, like, scheming to get his way. And when you look at Jacob's life, he's basically Jacob the schemer. He's the kind of person who analyzed a situation in life, and he figured out, all right, I may not be the strongest, and I might not be the best one at hunting and all that kind of stuff, but I can figure out how to get what I want by doing it my way. And I'll analyze this, and I'll come up with a plan, and I'll eventually get my goal by doing this plan. It might involve some deceit, a little bit of trickery and all that, but Jacob's idea was to survive life that way. Now, when you think about, you know, what Jacob has to do, God actually wants to knock that out of him. And you'll watch that today is what God does, is he makes Jacob face that in the events of life. And it's a good lesson to ourselves, because that's what God does with our weaknesses. He makes us face our weaknesses, and he puts us into situations where we're up against people that are just like us, and he forces us to see what we're really like. And it's good that he does that so that we can, like, look in the mirror and figure out what we have to work on. So you know what happened, like, and these are good old Sunday school stories. Remember in Genesis 25 how Jacob had figured out, all right, I know how to get the birthright out of Esau. I'll get the birthright out of him by, you know, wait until the right day when he's all famished and he's tired and he comes in and I'll make up some good food. And he'll be so hungry that in Genesis 25 you find out down at verse 33 that, sure, he's willing to do that. So Jacob said to him, well, you know, back at verse 32, Esau said, well, look, I'm about to die, so what profit is this birthright to me? And he really wasn't going to die, but he sort of felt that way. Maybe some of you felt that way yesterday after playing sports for a while, and you were out there running around all afternoon, and you come in for dinner, and you're like, oh, can't wait to eat, because you feel like you're going to die. Well, that's probably where Esau was really at. So Jacob says to him in verse 33, to swear to me at this day, and he swore to him, and he sold his birthright to Jacob, because Esau really didn't care about it. The New Testament commentary is don't be immoral like Esau. He really didn't care about his heritage. Didn't care that he was in the family line and the promises that God had gave. And he was willing to sell the birthright. And so, yeah, he went away. And it tells us in verse 34 that Esau despised his birthright. He really didn't care. God had offered him things, put him in a family where people could teach him the truth. Really didn't care. And he walked away from it. So you get up to Genesis 27, and you're at the point where, you know, this is as Isaac's getting older, and he's ready to bless the children. And it comes to pass when he's really old and his eyes were dim, in Genesis 27 at verse 1, that he could not see, and he calls his son Esau, his older son, and says to him, my son. And he tells him, all right, you know, go get some game for me, prepare me more food. This is what he liked out of this son, and he's going to bless him before he dies. And Rebekah's listening in verse 5, and she hears what he has to say. So Esau goes out to the field. Rebekah says to Jacob, and says, look, Jacob, here's what's going on. So we've got to do something. Bring me game in verse 7. Make savory food for me that I may eat it and bless it in the presence of the Lord before my death. That's what your father had said. So now, therefore, my son, obey my voice according to what I command you. And Rebekah comes up with a plan. And you know the story. So, you know, Jacob goes out, and he's got food. Rebekah's got it all ready. He goes in. He puts the hair on his arms to try to fake out his dad. He probably, like, made himself smell like animals really well, so he sort of smelled like Esau a little bit at least. And he goes in to trick his dad. So in verse 19, Jacob says to his father, I am Esau, your firstborn. Now, that wasn't true, right? So you know that this is covered in deceit. Now, it is true that when you look at the whole story, Rebekah may have known more than Isaac. She may have understood better than Isaac that Jacob was the promised son. So Rebekah's got some motive here. I think maybe a little bit better than even Jacob did at this point. But Jacob's just going along learning that here's how you get through life. You scheme your way through. You cheat, you deceive people, and this is how you get what you want. Now, you ever met any people in school like that? I mean, I saw a lot of kids in school like that. I watched them intimidate other people and scheme their way through, and a lot of kids have learned very well how to do this. And they may have learned from their parents or they learned from other siblings, but they found out really good how to scheme their way through life and get what they want. And it could be all kinds of scheming. Sometimes for the boys, it's more like intimidation kind of stuff where they come in. And then for the girls, they come up to the teachers and it's like, oh, you did such a good job today. You know? You ever played that game? Yeah. Let me tell you, the guys all know, the teachers, they know the games, you see, and yeah, they've seen it before. Anyways, but people still try it, you know. Generation goes, generation comes, and the next one group comes in and thinks, oh yeah, we can get away with this. You know, and that's the way life goes. And of course, you always had the class goofballs that figured the strategy was to get the teacher off the track so that if you could get them off the track, you could get through the whole day and not get the assignment done. And yeah, there's all those schemer people that are out there. So life is full of schemers. Anyways, but as you're going along through here, all right, you can just see that Jacob, really, he's playing along with this. Rebekah's playing along with the scheme, and it looks like, you know, things are going to go just fine. Verse 24, Isaac says to him, are you really my son Esau? And he says, I am. Oh, goes ahead, all right, and this is the way the game wins. So you come down to verse 35, all right, now Esau comes in verse 34. Esau heard the words of his father because he said, look, your brother already came in, I already blessed him. What in the world's going on? And now the game's over, all right? Because now you actually see it's played out. And he was blessed. Now, it's interesting, at the end of verse 33, when Isaac finally realizes, you know, he's trembling exceedingly, and he says, who? You know, what is the one that hunted the game and brought it to me? I ate all of it before you came, and I blessed him. And it's almost like, in the New King James, they put a big old slash right there, and they make you think, like, he's pausing. I blessed him. Oh, and he shall be blessed. And maybe the light turned on for his dad at that point, and he finally realized, Isaac found out what was going on. And he realized that in God's scheme of things, in God's plan, this is the way it was supposed to be. And he knew that. He knew that Jacob was the son of the promise. And he's finally realized, oh yeah, he shall be blessed. But Esau hears the words of his father. He cries with an exceeding great and bitter cry, and he says to his father, bless me, even me also, O my father. And he said, well, your brother came with deceit and has taken away your blessing. So, you know, the motive was not right. He came in with deceit. It wasn't up front. And Esau said, well, is he not rightly named Jacob? You know, the supplanter. You know, that's what he does. He was the schemer supplanter. For he has supplanted me these two times. He took away my birthright, and now look, he's taken away my blessing. And this is the way Esau felt. Now, for all of us that are sitting here, I think what you learn from this kind of thing is that the consequences of all of this, when you look at the scheming, you look at the plan, you figure out, well, did it work? Did it work? If the goal was for making sure that Jacob got the blessing, did the plan work? Sure, the plan works. But when you look at it in the whole overwhelming, you know, you look at the whole big game plan of things, you look at the consequences, now look what happens. You get down to verse 41, so Esau hated Jacob because of the blessing with which his father blessed him. And Esau said in his heart, the days of my mourning, when they're over, you know, I'll kill my brother Jacob. So this is what scheming gets us in life. What scheming is all about, when you use deceit and you go through life like this, is that you have very short-term goals. Your goal is just for the moment. I got to get to this point. And so we scheme our way through. We get to that point, and then after that, we don't really worry about the consequences that are going to come later on down the line. And in this case, the consequences are, now that he's split from his brother wants to kill him, and now Jacob's got a family member that now he's not going to be able to save this family member. This fellow wants to kill him. What a difference that we're going to look at in the exhortation with Joseph. He has a whole different approach to life. And Joseph's plan is to save people, whereas Jacob, in this case with Rebecca, they're out to look at how they can make sure that the blessing goes through to Jacob. And I really think maybe Rebecca had a little higher motive in all this than Jacob did. I'm not really sure at this point how much he understood about the promise that God had made. But in any way, you can see the way it's read by the people is, this is deceit, you know, you are lying, you are cheating in a sense, and now the feeling amongst the people that are on the other side of it is, I want to kill you, I'm going to get back at you. They want vengeance because of how they've been treated. So this is not a good strategy for family living. And you don't want to use this in your families. You don't want to cheat your brothers and sisters like this. You don't want to cheat moms and dads like this. Moms and dads shouldn't be treating you like this. This is not a valid strategy for life. Especially in the sense that all of us in our families, we're hoping we all be saved, just like Joseph was with his brothers. And there is no special blessing going down to a child, and God's already picked out one and said, Jacob I have loved, and Esau I have hated. We don't have that in our families. But you can certainly see the results of it in this case. This is what scheming gets you. Scheming gets anger, gets vengeance, gets people all upset, and that's what it does. Now, later on in this story, you move ahead to Genesis 27. Now that the brothers are like, they're splitting in a sense. So they've got like going two different ways at this point. And now what Esau's done is Esau's gone and he's taken wives amongst the Canaanites, amongst the Hittites that were in the land. So Rebecca reminds Jacob, and she says, reminds Isaac in this case, in Genesis 27 at verse 46, I'm weary of my life because of the daughters of Heth. Those are the girls in the area. And if Jacob takes a wife of the daughters of Heth, like these who are the daughters of the land, what good will my life be to me? And so she reminds Isaac of his responsibility. Just like Abraham had got his servant to go find Isaac a wife, she's reminding now Isaac that, look it, you've got to do something and step in here and make sure that Jacob ends up getting a spiritual wife, somebody who's a believer, somebody who cares about worshiping our God. And the daughters of Heth did not. They were just the people of the land, and they really didn't care. That's actually the last thing we find about Rebecca. That's the last that we know of her. She's looking out for Jacob's future, hoping that they'll find a wife for him that will help him then in developing a godly family and continue on the promises. And she really does come across, in the Bible record at least, as much as, even though she was scheming her way through this, at least she had a conscience and cared about the promises. She really does care that they go through Jacob as God had intended. Isaac seems to be a little more interested, at least the way he's presented, in eating of the meat. But she was a bit of a spiritual conscience for both of them. And I'm sure they discussed the issue in private, and they finally handled the issue, and Isaac did. He handles the issue, but he didn't really take a real positive direction in this whole thing. He's a little bit more laid back, and so in this case, Rebecca comes forward. Now, the charge that he gives to Jacob. In Genesis 28, here's the story. So, now he's going to respond. So, Isaac calls in Jacob, and he blessed him, and he charged him, and he said to him, "You shall not take a wife from the daughters of Canaan." Now, you know this yesterday, there's a lot of discussion about marriage, and about dating yesterday, and some of these stories as you're going through, and now you got another one. And that must be there in Genesis, young people, because God sees this as a real critical issue. It really matters who you marry. It matters that you find a believer. It matters that you find somebody who wants to serve God, because God wants you to have a happy, positive marriage for raising children. And so this is coming up. It's not like I made it up and it's like I keep bringing up the subject. As you read through Genesis, you will keep reading it, because God keeps throwing it in our face. Because he wants us to understand that this is a critical issue, and it matters. And all of you, you're at the time of life, at least a lot of you, at that point where you're looking around and thinking about what are you going to do in your future. And so you read these stories, and you realize how important it was to these people that they find a believing partner. That's what moms and dads wanted to find for them, and so that the kids would have good, happy lives, and that God would be able to work in their family, and hopefully raise godly children. So he calls him in and he says, "Look, arise, go to Padan Aram." Now Padan Aram would have been way back up there, up in Syria today, what we would call Syria. You're going to go way back up to around Haran, where Abraham's family used to be. The same basic area that Abraham had sent his servant Eliezer to find a wife for Isaac. And now Isaac says, "All right, here you go. You're going to go way back," and he's going to send Jacob up there this time. So Jacob's going to go, whereas Abraham had made sure he told his servant, "Don't take Isaac up there." But in this case, Jacob's going to go. And it could be that Abraham knew a little bit what the area was like, knew a little bit about the people that lived up there. Maybe he even knew Laban and realized that don't get Isaac near Laban. Well, Jacob's going to go up and he's going to meet Laban. And that's okay, because Jacob already was a bit like Laban. And now God's going to use Laban to knock that out of Jacob. So he sends him up to Padan Aram, to the house of Bethuel, your mother's father, and take yourself a wife from there of the daughters of Laban, your mother's brother. So may God Almighty bless you, make you fruitful and multiply you, and may you be an assembly of peoples, and give you the blessing of Abraham to you. Because he understood, Isaac realized the blessing of Abraham was going to go through Jacob, not through Esau. It's going to go through Jacob. And may you inherit the land of which you're a stranger and which God gave to Abraham. So he steps in at this point, gives the spiritual counsel which dads need to do, and he sets direction for his son. And we looked yesterday at obedience. You know, there are times where your parents may do this with you. And they understand it's in your best interest that you do this. And it may be a decision that you're making about going to college. Maybe moms and dads say, "Look, at the college you want to go to, it's away from ecclesial life. There's no spiritual value to you going there." And maybe they're trying to give you some direction about where you should end up going. And those are the times you got to listen to them, because they've been around for a while. They've seen things. Those of us that are older, we get older, and we can't play those sports as much as we used to when we were younger. But we've seen a lot in life, and we've watched people that we care about. We've watched them make decisions in life where they went down a pathway that we thought maybe wasn't going to be good for them, and we watched over time and saw them walk away. And sometimes decisions like that, you think it's so simple. You're just going to move away and go to college. And the next thing you know, you move away, you go to college, and we never see you again. The community never sees you again. And it has a huge impact on your life. So when moms and dads try to give you counsel like that, and try to give you guidance about your spiritual life, that's when we want to listen to them. And it's they really have seen it. And talk to them, about, well, what do you know? What's happened? And ask them questions about why not. It's okay to ask the why nots. Have them tell you why they're giving you that kind of counsel and direction. And in this case, that's what Isaac's trying to do with his son Jacob. So, in this case here, you're watching that he's going to go away. And so now, you look at as a result for what Rebecca was willing to give up. In this case, I think it's interesting to look at her as a mom. She stepped in, got involved, went through that process involving deceit. And in the end, what that's going to cost her now is she never sees Jacob again. And that's because, in a sense, of how this whole thing was handled. So in Genesis 28 then, what you find is that Jacob's looking for God's help in his life, all right? And he has this dream. So he's on his way, he's going to walk up to Padan Aram, and he gets as far as Bethel, and he goes and he's laying down for the night. Some of you probably had some nice dreams last night after all that activity yesterday. And Jacob dreams, and he sees this ladder. And you've seen the story of Jacob's ladder. And what he watches in this ladder is that angels were, what were they doing? Were they descending and ascending, or were they ascending and descending? You might think, well, what does that ever matter? But, you know, what God was trying to explain to Jacob is, look at the angels. What they're doing is they're going up and they're coming down because they're here all the time. Jacob needed some confidence right now. He needed an assurance that God was with him. And he sees this vision of God's angels working with him, and they're going up to heaven where they go and they talk out issues and they work out things, and they're coming back down because they're with Jacob in his life. And God promises at this time. He says to him in verse 15, look, I am with you. When he watches the ladder and he sees them ascending and descending. And the Lord is standing up there above it, and he says, I am the Lord God of Abraham, your father, and the God of Isaac. So this is the God that your fathers worship. This is the God that gave the promises. This is the God who made the promises that will go through you. And he says, look at the land on which you lie. I will give it to you and your descendants. So God promised to be with them in verse 15. I am with you, and I will keep you wherever you go, and will bring you back to this land. For I will not leave you until I have done what I have spoken to you. And then Jacob awakes. So Jacob got the assurance that he was looking for. He's got a commitment from God that he will take care of you. Very similar to the commitments God really makes to all of us. That when you are part of God's elect, when God has chosen you as he had chosen Jacob, he promises that he will be with you. That's why when Paul gets to Romans 8, when he's writing his letter trying to convince the people about the benefits and the blessings that we have in Christ Jesus, and he gets to Romans 8, he says, look, who can separate you from the love of God? You know, who's going to bring a charge against you? Do you think Jesus Christ is going to bring a charge against you? Do you think he's going to condemn you when he gave his life for you to save you? Do you think God's going to condemn you? Is he going to bring a charge against you? Because God, he was willing to give his own son to save you. Paul says, look at everything's on your side. And this is the assurance that Jacob was looking for, that nothing can separate you from the love of God in Christ Jesus. And it's true for us again today. So in Genesis 29, when Jacob finally gets up there, he gets all the way up to Paddan Aram, and he gets up there and he sits down at the well. It's very similar to when Abraham's servant Eliezer had come up to the well. He sits down at the well and he starts talking, but this time it's Jacob instead of the servant. And he stops at the well, and look who just happens to be coming to the well. There she shows up, and he happens to meet Rachel. And that's it. And he finds out, wow, this is it. You're in the right family, all right? And he decides this is going to be his wife. And so he goes back and meets Laban, and the whole story unfolds. But you can see it happened because these people were committed. They honestly believed that angels worked in their lives. They were willing to trust God in decisions that they made. And they're going to go somewhere. And they pray about it all the way there and pray that God will bless the situation. And when they get there and see that God's work is unfolding before them, they read the signs and realize, wow, God really is working in this and doing something for us that we never could have done. So he makes the deal with Laban, and he says, look, all right, I want to marry Rachel. And Laban is the businessman. Laban is the schemer of all schemers. So what God has done in this case is has Jacob go up to Paddan Aram, all right, and he gets up there and he finds out exactly where Rebekah came from. This is her brother, right, his mom. And he gets up there and finds out, this is where she learned all that scheming. See, he learned it from Laban. This family schemes. He was the ultimate schemer. And so Jacob's now having to face his own approach to life. He's going to face it in Laban, and God's going to teach him some good lessons from that. And it's good to see. So he gets up there and he makes the deal with Laban, says, look, for 7 years, all right? 7 years I'll serve you, and I'm going to marry this woman. Now, anybody here think they're going to survive a 7-year engagement? What would you think about that? 7 years, you find the right girl, and what do you think? You guys, you going to survive 7 years? What do you think? Going to work for her? Is she worth it? Well, you might think she's worth it. You don't find today, there aren't very many 7-year engagements. Because usually we find today that people find out that, wow, after 7 years, that's too long to wait. They spend too much time together and they decide they want to get married because they want to have a physical relationship. Jacob's willing to wait 7 years for this girl. 7 years. And sometimes you read over these stories really fast and you don't actually think about, wow, what was that really like? And it's not like he was down in Israel and she's up in Paddan Aram and they have some kind of long-distance relationship where they Skype each other or something like that. It didn't work like that. I mean, he's actually living up in the exact same area, probably sees her every day, and has to wait 7 years to marry her. Now, that's commitment. But see, this is commitment that people of God make. You know, he was willing to do this for God and realize it was worth waiting. And I think that's a good lesson for everybody today, because you are going to be surrounded by people in your schools and colleges who don't wait, And they just decide they're going to test drive their marriage. They're going to find out ahead of time. And they get together, they live together, they have physical relationships, and then they decide whether they really want to get married. But that's not the Bible approach, and it's so clear. Because God is using this to test us about faithfulness, about our patience, you know, whether or not he can give us eternal life. And these are the kind of things that God puts in front of us to find out whether he can trust us. Can he really trust us with eternal life? And so these aren't just like simple little things that, oh, it doesn't really matter. It does, because God will be making decisions for our life based on decisions that we make at this point about whether he can trust us. And sure, there are times where people mess up, and they do make mistakes. You know, but hopefully at that point, then, they go through major changes and realize, wow, I don't want to do that again. You look at the life of David, and you see how much David was changed when he committed adultery with Bathsheba. But it wasn't just that, oh, that was a mistake, oh, God, please forgive me, and gets on with his life. I mean, it actually really changed his character. He became a different person in how he treated people. You actually read that in David's character. He was extremely more merciful and less judgmental than he had been previous to that. It actually totally changed David. And God can use things like that when we mess up. But that's not the standard. That's not the goal. The goal is that we hold on and we're faithful, because God's using this to test out our faithfulness. And when you get to your schools and you talk to people, those of you that go to public school, you go to college, you find out that, you know, this was an article that was back 7 years ago, that 95% of Americans had premarital sex. 95%. When they ask, you know, this is including like older folks. You know, they went back and they surveyed all these different people of different ages and found out this is what really had been going on in America. And although, you know, back in my generation, people maybe they hid it better, but it was still happening. And so the challenge is out there to all of you to be like a Joseph and be willing to resist and find out this is a test of faithfulness. Can God trust you with eternal life? And he uses things like this to find out if we're trustworthy. And so we want to wait. Because God's plan in marriage isn't that we just test drive it. His plan is that we learn to trust him. We trust God. We learn to develop faith in him. And that's what we're really trying to do. And marriage is just one of those ways. And the experience that you have when you're dating and you're in a courtship with somebody, those are the times when God's looking to see how our character is really developing. So Jacob, he learns the hard way, but here he's 7 years is finally up. Imagine that day, goes through the wedding thing, whatever they would have had. My guess is it probably involved drinking some alcohol, because I really don't understand how Jacob could have possibly gone into a tent with Leah if he had been sober. And my guess is that he probably was not totally sober at this point and didn't even realize what was happening. But there he goes into the tent, spends the night, wakes up in the morning and finds out, who did he lay with all night? Well, it wasn't his beloved Rachel. It's her sister. And then Laban spills the beans to him and says, well, that's not how we do it in our area up here. Didn't you know the rules? The way we do it up here is the older one always goes first. Well, I don't know how that didn't come out in 7 years between Rachel and Leah and Laban, but for 7 years he's up there. Nobody ever told him that. But in the end, this is what God does to us in life. When we have weaknesses like this, when we're like the kind of person that's a schemer or whatever our weakness happens to be, God matches us up sometimes with other people who use the same approach in life. And then it comes back on top of us. And then we get to find out what it's like to be treated like that. And Jacob, you can imagine how he just like in that moment when he woke up and finally realized what had gone on, how upset he was, how angry he was, and how much he just wanted to, you know, go to Laban and talk to him right away. And God would be telling him, this is how Esau felt when you tricked him. This is the way he felt. And now you know what it's really like. So this is what God does. This is what angels do. They come up with techniques and they come up with strategies in our lives to make us face our weaknesses. And they don't do it because they hate us. They do it because they're trying to show us what we're like, hoping that we will change. And that's basically the strategy right there. So you don't want to then take vengeance on people. You don't want to get so angry you want to kill somebody, or you want to get back at them, or you make a plan where you're going to, well, they're going to pay for this. That isn't what we do. Instead, you look at life and say, all right, the angels are using this. I'm supposed to learn something from this. And we move on and find out, wow, I don't want to treat somebody else that way. And that's what we can learn from it. So instead of getting angry at other people when they mistreat us, what we want to do is analyze, how do I feel? How does that make me feel? How do I want to respond? And make sure we both respond the right way. And then and figure out, well, I want to make sure I never treat somebody else the way I just got treated, because look at how it made me feel. And that's really what we can learn when people mistreat us. So Jacob makes a choice at that point. He had a tough decision, if you think about it. He really could have just accepted the fact that now he's married to Leah. He could have, and left Rachel at that point. But 7 years he'd worked for her. He'd already dreamed about her being his wife. And so Jacob decides to make the choice that he's going to marry Rachel too. All right, and he decides, all right, I'll work another 7 years for you. Now, most people figure that probably at that point he went ahead and gave Rachel as a wife, but Jacob committed to working another 7 years. But it's still a tough call at that point. What do you actually do when God brings these things into your life? Now, could Jacob at that point just decide, sorry, Rachel, I'm already married, I've got one wife, that's all I can support, and I'll take Leah and walk away? He could have done that. He could have. But he didn't. Jacob was allowed to make the choice, and his choice was, I'll take Rachel too. Now, what's fun to watch about God is that God can work with that. God could have worked with Leah, only Leah, but God can work with Leah and with Rachel. And as you watch this story unfold, you can find out, well, this is really what God was sort of hoping would happen out of all this, because then in the end, Jacob has this huge family, and now you have in the patriarchs, you have Abraham, the spiritual father, who works through his only begotten son, Isaac, who then has a family of the 12 sons of Jacob, who then became the family of Israel, from which the whole community was named. And you have the father and the son and the ecclesia in that family. And so angels are actually orchestrating things behind the scenes that are much bigger issues than just Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. That's what their plan was all about as all of this is unfolding with the people. But and it's fun to see at least that God can work with the choices that we make at times. We pray about it, and God is flexible. It's not like there was only one way to go. He could have gone either way. Remember, I told Moses that. He said, Moses, stand aside, and I'll destroy the people, and I'll make out of you a great nation. God, the angel wasn't just bluffing at that point. He was serious. I'll really do that. And that's what he would have done. So Jacob goes in and he marries Rachel at that point. All right, and now you've got a really interesting situation. You got two sisters married to the same guy. And not only that, but the guy loves one of them and feels the other one cheated him. And that's the feeling. Now, this is how you start out this game, all right? And now two wives, and it's a recipe for disaster. Anybody know later on in the law, when the law of Moses was written, was this actually something that a fellow was allowed to do? Could you marry two sisters like that? You know what? No, actually, God put that in the law. Said, don't do that. All right? If you want to know why, go back and look at this case. But you don't really want to do that because it causes too much envy and jealousy and anger. And it's just not a good recipe for a nice, successful marriage. But this is what Jacob's got now. So, right? So when the Lord saw that Leah was unloved, then he opens up her womb. Now, see what angels do in our lives? They actually analyze what's happening. They look at how we're responding to situations. Jacob loves Rachel. He's not really treating Leah very well. She's an unloved wife. And so what God does in this case, he says, all right, Leah, you can have the children, not Rachel. And he closes up Rachel's womb and he opens up Leah's, because God's working in their lives. Now, an angel doesn't just show up and say, this is what we're doing. This is what happened. And this is what your life is like. Angels are doing things in your life like this all the time. They're orchestrating events of your life just like they did with Jacob, because they're trying to give us direction. And Jacob should have been reading the signs. What God's trying to help me understand right here, when Leah becomes pregnant and has a son, is God's trying to help me to love Leah. And that's really what should have happened in this case. But it's almost an impossible situation, because Leah and Rachel didn't even get along, as you see as you go through the story. You can imagine how Jacob may have blamed Leah for the going along with the deceit. You know, if you had been Jacob, wouldn't you? It's like, Leah, didn't you know what was going on? You knew I loved Rachel. 7 years, she probably talked to you about this, that we were going to get married, and you agreed to come into me that night? You know, it's like blame, blame, blame. And you can imagine how the blame game went around. But for the young people, that's not a good solution of life. If we start blaming people for all their mistakes, instead of recognizing that God has brought this into our life, you are going to have one angry, upset, disappointing life, and you're not going to be a very happy person. This is what happens to people when they let anger eat them out, and they blame people all the time for stuff that they did to you. If that's the kind of person you are, you will have a very unhappy life. The people that let go of it and realize, wow, God's working in this somehow. Somehow God is going to bring good out of this. The people that have the faith to let go, those are the people that have happy lives. That's what you find out when you read Ecclesiastes. It's like Solomon looks back and realizes you want happiness in life. Let go of all that stuff. And you're going to be a much happier person and believe that God is working in your life. And in this case, that's what Jacob should have done. And hopefully over time, he did learn to do that. But look what envy and jealousy do. When you have this, when you scheme within a family and you get your way and you think that, Leah would have thought, oh yeah, I've got to get married. You know, nobody really wanted me because I wasn't the good-looking girl, but I've got a husband now. This isn't good. It doesn't work out in a positive situation at all. So in Genesis 38, verse 1, when Rachel saw that she bore children, Jacob bore no children, Rachel envied her sister. And she said to Jacob, give me children or else I die. Like, can you imagine some girl coming to you guys and saying that? Like, give me children or else I die. Like, you know, well, what am I supposed to do? It's like, I tried everything I could. It's like, I guess maybe today you could go see a fertility counselor or something like that. I don't think they had that back then. But that's the frustration level you could imagine was going on in this family. They were so frustrated. They were so angry at each other. And this is what all of this brought, was anger and frustration and people that mistreated each other. You know, to where now this is husband and wife, give me children or else I die. And this is the way she felt. You know, and in the end, what happened? She finally had children, and children killed her. She actually got her wish in the end. She ended up dying, giving birth to Benjamin. So it's pretty sad, but that's really what happened in her life. But she had let this like become such a big issue in her life. She'd let this like override everything. And she should have like set back, and she should have analyzed the situation, prayed about it. You know, like Isaac and Rebekah had waited 20 years to have that first child. And she's now in this situation of seeing her sister pregnant. She's pregnant again. She's having another one. And it's like, oh, you know, I'm never going to live this down. And she's all worried about herself. Give me children or else I die. So, you know, you look at this is the way the natural man is. This is the devil in us and amongst the girls. And you can see that it rises itself amongst childbearing. You know, I've seen this happen in ecclesial life where sometimes young couples get married. And some young couples end up having children and others don't. And sometimes they never have children, and they have to accept that in life, that God is not going to have them have children. And they have to go through life like that, realizing God didn't open their womb. And what you then do is you can either sit there and get angry about it and get frustrated and be jealous of all the other people that are having children, or you can jump into their lives and do, like, what can I do to help out? You can get in there and teach Sunday school. You can work with children other ways. You can have people over and you can take care of their children. And sure, it's not the same. It's not the same. But God has made a choice for you. And God's helping, he's trying to help you through life and learn some lessons of life because he knows what he's doing. And you can have that confidence that he knows what he's doing. The angels don't make mistakes like this. They talk about these things with each other in heaven, and they come down and get involved in our lives, and they know the game plan. They know what the goal is and what they have to work on. And all we got to do is trust them because they will work out these issues in our life. So you look at the results of scheming in this case. You know, now Esau hated Jacob back in Genesis 27. Now you got Leah is hated as a result of scheming when they get married. And now you got the two sisters that don't like each other as well because one of them's having children, the other one's not. And you can see there's the problem with scheming. It really is a short-term solution. It's not a good strategy for working out life. It's just going to make people angry at you, and it's not going to help you solve your problems. So this story that's in here in Genesis is such a good one to look at. Here's a strategy for living life that's terrible, and then you're going to read it. Joseph comes on the scene, and he has such a different strategy. His brothers were like this. His brothers, they were schemers, just like in this case with Jacob, but not Joseph. Joseph's not a schemer. He's the kind of person that trusts God from early on as a young person, and Joseph has a whole different kind of life. So look at the mess Jacob's life is. He's gone up to Padan Aram. He ran away from Esau. Now he's gone up here, and he stayed here now for like maybe in the end about 20 years. You know, that's about how long he's probably up there. This whole family develops. So now he's got two wives up there. You know, he's got his brother Esau hates him. And now he's up there with his two wives. He's also got Bilhah and Zilpah. He's got two handmaids. So he's got four women now that are like wives with him, which are all having children with him. And his family's just full of jealousy. All these kids are growing up in a family environment where it's like, this is not the way it's supposed to be. You've got moms that don't like each other and they're playing games with each other like this. And the children, you know what it's like when you see people playing games. You grow up, you're smart, you can see the games that people play. And imagine growing up in these families, watching the way Leah and Rachel treated each other and what was going on in the family. And you know, you kids, you pick it up. And these kids did too. And they grew up realizing this is how you get through life, you scheme. And that's what Joseph's brothers learned. They learned how to do this way up here in Paddan Aram. The family was full of jealousy and envy and anger. He lives with an uncle, Laban, you know, Rebecca, his mom's brother. And this uncle doesn't care about his kids at all. All he wants to know is what can he make out of them. And so this uncle, he takes his daughters and he sells them off, basically, to find out how much can I make on these girls. And he basically sells them off by having Jacob work for him for 7 years for each one. And his children, you look at Jacob, he's so frustrated. He's thinking, I'm the child of the promise. God made this promise to me that he would bring me back and give me this land. I'm supposed to be the one through who the promises to Abraham are going to flow. And he looks at his family, and it's a mess. It's just a disastrous mess. And that's what happens sometimes in life for us. You wonder, like, how is God ever going to bring any good out of this? How could it possibly happen? But what God's trying to do with Jacob, he's trying to like bring him down to a point where, Jacob, there's so many things happening in your life right now, there's no way you're going to scheme your way out of this one. Yeah. And see, that's what God has to do to us, though, at times. Because if you're good at scheming and you're good at playing those games, you think you're really good at this. You get confident at it and you think, all right, I almost don't need God because I could take care of this. And so finally the angels bring so many things that are bearing down on your life, you finally realize that I can't solve all this. This is beyond me even to scheme my way out of this one. And that's where Jacob has come to right now. And he's finally at a point where he realizes he can't scheme his way out of this. What is he going to do? Esau's down there, hates him, wants to kill him. Laban's up there. Laban's chasing him away as Jacob's running on, and it's, you know, Rachel stole the family god. Laban's coming after him. And it's like, where is he going to go? And his family is a disaster. And this is what God does. And so if you ever live in a family like this where you feel like your family's a disaster, and you think, like, what are you going to do? What you do is you follow the life of Jacob. You go through what he did to recover. He turned to God. He prayed to God. He pleaded with God to solve those problems. And he moved forward believing he wasn't going to solve them anymore, but God would solve them and God would take care of them. And when God finally brought him to that point, then Jacob was ready. So God intervened. He says to him in Genesis 31, he says, all right, Jacob, it's time to go. We're going to leave Paddan Aram. You know, it's time. You got your family developed right now. It's time to get out of here. Laban really doesn't like you. All right, you've got this family of kids. They don't get along real well. You got these wives that aren't doing so good as well. And he says, it's time to leave. Time to get out of this place. We're going to go back home. So Jacob informs Rachel. He tells Rachel and Leah in verse 4 of chapter 31, God said, it's time to go. And I see your father's countenance, that it's not favorable toward me as before. He realizes Laban doesn't like him anymore because Laban's got no more girls that he can give him and no more money to make off of Jacob. And now what Jacob's doing, the longer he stays, the more of Laban's flock he takes. And all Laban sees now is, man, this guy's just draining me. And before he was making money on him and he liked Jacob. But now that Jacob's taken away his animals, it's like, ooh, this isn't going to work for Laban at all. So he meets with them, and he gives them God's commands. He says, look, God says it's time to go. And the family did. They left. To their credit, they followed and did what God had said. And God protected Jacob from Paddan Aram. He protected him and said, look, Laban, don't touch him. And God took care of him there. And what Jacob had to learn was that now that he's coming down and he's going to have to face Esau, God will take care of him there too. Because God was the one in control, not Jacob. So he does. He makes Jacob face his past right here. He comes down in Genesis 32. All right, and he's left Laban now, and they're on their way back down. And they're coming down on the eastern side of the Jordan. They're coming down from Syria, like through the area of what we would call today like Lebanon over there. And over in Jordan. So he's coming down from Syria into Jordan, and they're coming along the Jordan River, and they're going to cross over. So the messengers, he sends out messengers to find out what's it going to be like when we get down there to see Esau. What has Esau got? I haven't seen him for 20 years. I wonder what he's got. So the messengers come back and they say, we met your brother Esau. He's coming out to meet you with 400 men. 400. And what's Jacob got? Jacob's got no army. Jacob's got four wives and a bunch of kids. And he's going to meet up with 400 men. Well, Jacob's greatly afraid and he's distressed. And I think you would be too, all right? That he divided the company that were with him. He put the flocks and the herds in the front. So Jacob's got, he's got flocks and herds and camels. And that's, I don't know what that does with 400 men, but yeah, that's what he's going to put out there. He's going to put all this stuff out there and show his brother Esau, look what God blessed me with. That, and that's going to be his strategy now. He's not going to come in with force anymore, no deceit. He's going to put all this out there and say, God has blessed me. And he's going to take a different strategy. So he says, look, if Esau comes to the one company and attacks it, maybe the other company will escape and survive, because he's really not sure what God's going to do in this case. But that's our strategy for life, young people, is we got to admit our mistakes and we got to move on. And now he's going to have to face Esau and he's going to have to apologize for mistakes that he made earlier in life. And this is what God has in store for Jacob. So Jacob comes down on the eastern side and he gets to the Jabbok River, which is probably about halfway down between the Sea of Galilee and the Dead Sea. He's at the Jabbok River and he sends his family across the river. And then what he does at night is he goes back to the other side. He's the only one on the northern side of the Jabbok River. Everybody else has already gone across. And that's where he is when he spends the night. And he is in trouble. Laban's behind him. Esau's in front of him. His family's a mess and they're all divided. His children, they're not interested in God. Even his wife, it seems like, you know, Rachel runs away with all the household gods. You know, and now he's moving back home and he's got this big family and all he's got is a bunch of flocks and that's about it. But at this point in his life, this is when he finally makes his conversion. And he realizes, I can't scheme my way through this. I'm going to have to depend on God. So an angel appears to him that night and is going to talk to Jacob. Only this time, Jacob's got a plan. I'm not going to just talk to the angel this time. I'm going to grab the angel. I'm going to hold on to him until he talks to me and promises me that he's going to get me through this. And that's what he does. When you read that story of Jacob wrestling with the angel, he's wrestling with the angel because he wants the angel to bless him. This is what he's after. Promise me you're going to do something I haven't been able to do. My family's a mess. I can't do this anymore. I can't scheme my way through this. Promise me that you're going to solve this problem. You're going to change my children. You're going to turn them into spiritual kids. I haven't been able to do this. I haven't been able to save my wives. And Jacob is in trouble at this point. And he holds on to the angel and he pleads with the angel all night. He's holding on to him and he won't let him go. That's actually what's happening in this story. It's not a power struggle at all. It's a pleading with an angel that, please do something that I haven't been able to do. And he reminds, you know, the angel back in Genesis 28, you promised me that you would bring me back to this land and give me the promise of Abraham. Now, you know, if you think that's not the case, all you do is read Hosea and you find that out, because the prophet Hosea comments on this exact event. And he said, look at in chapter 12 at verse 2, the Lord also brings a charge against Judah and will punish Jacob according to his ways. According to his deeds, he will recompense him, because at this point in time when Hosea is writing this prophecy, the whole nation was acting like Jacob. They were scheming their way through. They weren't really following the ways of God. Look what Jacob did. He took his brother by the heel in the womb, and he looks back at the beginning with Esau. This is where he started. He struggled, you know, at that point. In his strength, he struggled with God because he thought he could do it. And he struggled with the angel, and he prevailed. But how did he prevail with the angel? Not by beating the angel up. It wasn't some wrestling match like I saw over there in the dining hall where the guys get together and they wrestle each other down and the guy on top wins. No, no, this isn't what was going on. Jacob prevailed because he wept and he sought favor from the angel. He's crying. He's pleading with the angel. Do something for my family. I can't do. I can't scheme my way out of this anymore. And when people finally get to a point where they talk to God like that and you're willing to let God take control of your life, that's when God can get involved. It's wonderful. You know, it's sort of sad to read, but this is what changes people. God had to bring him to this point so that he can convert him and change him. And now he promises to bring him back to the land, and he promises he'll change his family. Now, I don't think Jacob realized what the change was going to take. When an angel promises you, yeah, I'll save you. I'll save your family. He doesn't realize that what's in store of all that is that his favorite son, Joseph, is going to seem like it's killed and taken from him. And he's going to be gone and separated him from years. And finally, in the end, his brothers are going to be changed. Finally, these children are going to be changed. He didn't realize all that back then. But at least he understood that God would do for him what he hadn't been able to do at this point. And it's a very similar experience that a lot of us go through and a lot of people go through. But when it works, to the young people that are here, when you do this, when you go through an experience of life like that, and you reach a point where God has done something for you that you know you couldn't do yourself, Tell people about it. Admit that I couldn't do this. God did this for me. God intervened in my life. And give the honest witness that it was God's, give him the credit, as Jacob does. When he finally meets up with Esau, look at what he tells Esau in Genesis 33. He lifts up his eyes, and Esau sees all the women and the children. He said, "Who are these with you?" And Jacob says, "Well, these are the children whom God has graciously given your servant." And he gives Esau all these presents, and he says, "Look, please take all these blessings that I brought to you, because God has graciously dealt with me. You know, this is how he's treated me, and I want to share it with you. I've got plenty, and I'm willing to share." So this is what faithful people do. When you reach a point in life where you've been brought to a point and you realize, I can't do it, and you plead with God to do for you what you haven't been able to do, then at that point, God can step in, he can intervene, and he can now work with he's got Jacob to a point now where Jacob is like moldable clay, and he can shape Jacob, and he can form him and his children, he promises to do this with, and turn them into children of God that he can give immortality to. It's a wonderful story when you watch that, because I think what happens in life, probably most of us are more like Jacob than we are like Joseph. Now, it's a fun story to have a look at, but we don't have time this morning, so we'll look at that one. But if you ever get a chance and you read Romans 9, it's a good follow-up on this, because in Romans 9, you finally find out the angels were orchestrating something in this whole event. When you go back and look at Abraham having his two children, and he has Ishmael and he has Isaac, and you wonder, like, why did God pick Isaac and he didn't use Ishmael? And the Jews went back and they looked at, and they always looked at themselves as being, well, we're children of Abraham. And they forgot that they were children of Abraham through Isaac. And there was also children of Abraham through Ishmael. There was a whole other group. And God didn't pick that group. He only picked the ones that are of Isaac. And then God knew the Jews would be thinking, well, but he didn't pick Ishmael's kids because they were children of that bond lady. She was a slave woman, and that's why he didn't pick those. And so then in the next generation down, have you ever wondered why God gave Isaac and Rebekah twins? You ever wondered why? Why did he give them twins and say the younger will serve the older? That's so that forever, ever, that the children of God could look back and realize it's not about him who wills, and it's not about him who runs. It wasn't up to mom and dad, but it was of God who makes the choice. And Paul actually writes all that up in Romans 9, if you ever look it up sometime. And he says, look at how God's election works. God makes choices. He could have picked people in your neighborhood. He could have picked children from all over this world, and he could have turned them into his children. But what God has done for the sake of the fathers, for the sake of your parents, your aunts and uncles who pray for you, God is giving you first choice. It's a wonderful story that Paul brings out in Romans 9. And God's election works like that. You have a privileged position. Don't ever take it for granted, and don't ever fail to appreciate it. You have been given an opportunity to be called into the family of God. Appreciate it, go for it, love it, and thank God that he's done something for you you could never do for yourself and that you could never earn. And that's what Paul brings out in Romans 9. It's a wonderful story. And we just did that in Sunday school recently back in Simi Valley, and it was a fun one to look at. So from Jacob's life, what you can at least learn is give up scheming and pray to God. Talk to God and bring your problems to him. But fathers, you guys that end up being fathers, be good spiritual counselors for your children, like we should do. God's actively working behind the scenes. I really think that something comes out of this story very clear. God is extremely active working in these things, and he's active today the same way, behind the scenes through his angels. Make your choices with prayer and faith, asking God to make them work as these people did. You have to go forward. You have to make choices. But you do it talking to God, praying that God will bless the choices that you have made, and looking for direction. And give up on the envy and the jealousy, and accept what God has given you. That's what Jacob had to eventually do, and it was a much more positive point in his life. And face the issues of the past. If we made mistakes, we've done things, maybe with young people that are here, maybe with moms and dads, maybe with your siblings back home. Maybe it's time to go home and face those mistakes, and apologize to people and say you're sorry. And move forward. Go forward in life instead of dealing with the past all the time. And when you do make progress, and God blesses your efforts, make sure you always give God credit. Give him the credit. It's not us. It's God working in us to his honor and his glory. And hopefully in the exhortation this morning, then, a few minutes, we had a chance to look at how God looked at the events in Joseph's life and how he took all those nasty, bad events that were going on in Joseph's life and he turned them into good, so that Joseph could accomplish his goal of saving his family.